Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Boy, September 10th, 2020. We have these Trump Woodward tapes, these revelations from a whistleblower in the Department of Homeland Security, and out west, the sky has turned into, well, it must be like what's like to be on Mars, this, you know, apocalyptic red as these massive wildfires continue to rage. And who better to talk about this with than Tim Miller? Hey, by the way, good morning, Tim. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning, Charlie. I'm just shocked that I'm getting the top billing over Tom Ridge, former.
Well, I was going to mention that we have a doubleheader today because there's so much stuff going on with 53 days to go. First half of the podcast is going to be Tim Miller, and then we're going to be talking with Tom Ridge, two-term governor of Pennsylvania, the first ever Secretary of Homeland Security. And he's got some thoughts, I'm hoping, about what's going on in the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, so for people who are looking for seriousness, you know, they can just fast forward 30 minutes and
we can do that. And he's very, very involved in the whole issue of mail-in voting in this, speaking of apocalypses that are coming our way. Hey, before we get started, Tim, you actually live out there in the hellscape of California. So can you see the sky or is it... Or is it like end time still there?
Yeah, we'll see what happens today. And we're taping this at 7:30, so it's pretty overcast, but that's normal out here in foggy Bay Area. We'll see if it clears up today. Yesterday was bizarre. I mean, you are right. It is not an overstatement at all to say it had surface of Mars vibes here. You know, you walked outside and it was like in one of those movies where they put the screen on where everything is orange, you know, kind of an orangish red. There were, you know, I was on a Zoom with Bill Kristol yesterday morning around 10:30, and I brought it outside to show him, and he's like, "So the cars on your street have headlights on still at 10:30? I mean, it's a very strange deal. And you know, last week we really couldn't go outside much at all because the air quality was so bad to breathe and kind of smell. It sort of smelled like a campfire everywhere around town. And that has dissipated, at least for now. So at least the air quality is better. Hopefully, you know, one of these days we can get back to our normal 72 degrees and sunny out here before, you know, kind of climate change wrecks our glorious, you know, California paradise.
It does feel like one of these sort of cosmic answers to all of those tweets, you know, showing, you know, some Antifa rioters in Portland, you know, saying this is Joe Biden's America. Yeah. And then God goes, no, look at the sky. This is Donald Trump's America. Big
orange.
You know, you don't have to go to social media to see this. By the way, just a heads up for folks, you are doing a Snapchat video every single week, that people can find on Snapchat. And I got to tell you, I was telling you right before we started this, I think it is absolutely fantastic for Bulwark fans. If you all have access to, either a teenager, who has Snapchat or you can figure out how to do that yourself, you really ought to look this up. So what is it called?
Yeah, it's called Not My Party. So if you just swipe left on your Snapchat app and search for Not My Party, it'll come up and you can subscribe. Or as Charlie said, you can find a teenager in your life or on the street and they'll be able to, you know, pull it up for you in about 5 seconds. So Not My Party. And I started this week. I've been, you know, we've done two of them now. And, you know, I think that they were hoping that the teens could get kind of a non, you know, a Charlie Kirk view of conservatism. And so I've spent a lot of time ranting about Donald and Bannon, of course, but I did, you know, on the topic of California today, get to spend a little bit of time talking about the fact that, you know, our leadership out here has decided that the correct response to the fires is that everybody turns off their AC, which has, you know, unfortunately, I hate it when they make Fox right, but it has made for a kind of a weird situation out here where, you know, we're surrounded by fire and stranded by a pandemic and we're told we can't use our electricity because they've offlined all the plants and are, you know, trying to rush us to our great solar future. The solar energy future, you know, hopefully we can reach it soon, but, you know, when the sky sky is filled with soot, it creates some problems.
Yeah, we've seen the future, and it's old people really sweating a lot. Yeah. I don't know. Okay, because this is a serious podcast, we should really jump right into the revelations by Bob Woodward. This is just an amazing thing. It does have this Watergate vibe. I have to admit that the whole, you know, what did the president know? When did he know it? What did he do? Well, we now know all of that. Also, the fact that, you know, what, 50 years, 40 some years after President Nixon is done in by tapes, what does Donald Trump do? He makes his own tapes with one of the reporters that brought down the Nixon presidency. I mean, it's like, whoa, the dots have connected. So, and I want to talk about what we learned and the significance of this, and whether the big question would be, is this actually going to make a difference this time? But I have to tell you, Tim, there's one delicious little aspect of this that I wanted to start off with. So the people are wondering, what was Donald Trump thinking? Why would you sit down with Bob Woodward? It never works out well for presidents who sit down with Bob Woodward, right? But the president, of course, is surrounded by brilliant people who are always telling him, you know, what he ought to do. My initial reaction was that it was just his vanity, that, you know, he thinks, I'm the president of the United States. I can tell my story. I can manipulate Bob Woodward. His first book wasn't that bad. I can handle anything. But 18 interviews, including these tape recorded interviews. Well, now, as the finger pointing, because this turns out to be so disastrous, somebody needs to be thrown under the bus. And the person who's risen to, like, the, you know, first in the queue is, of all people, Lindsey Graham. So Tucker Carlson, who is of course, an inveterate Trump defender, fluffer, goes on in a monologue blaming Lindsey Graham for this idea. Let's just play this.
Sat for repeated interviews with Bob Woodward. Why in the world would he do that? Well, tonight, from a source who knows the answer to that mystery, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. It was Lindsey Graham who helped convince Donald Trump to talk to Bob Woodward. Lindsey Graham brokered that meeting. Lindsey Graham even sat in on the first interview between Bob Woodward and the president. How'd that turn out? Now, remember, Lindsey Graham is supposed to be a Republican, so why would he do something like that? You'd have to ask him.
Why?
But keep in mind that Lindsey Graham has opposed, passionately opposed, virtually every major policy initiative that Donald Trump articulated when he first ran, from ending illegal immigration to pulling back from pointless wars to maintaining law and order at home. Lindsey Graham was against all of that more than many Democrats. So maybe you already know the answer.
Lindsey Graham, just... I'm sorry. Hey, by
nice
the way...
Nice little throat toss in there about how Lindsey Graham doesn't like the immigrants.
If this lasts for more than 4 hours, I will seek medical attention. But so Lindsey Graham, who has just been sucking up and sucking up and sucking up and sucking up, once it gets the reminder that you cannot suck up enough, right? You just can't. There is no level of sycophancy that is going to get you a pass if they decide they're coming for you. But I think the hilarious thing is that the focus here is not that the president of the United States basically crapped the bed, right? It is that who let this guy in to record him crapping the bed?
There's so many layers to this, Charlie. It's like, on the one hand, there is just the kind of Dan Dresner-esque, like the toddlerization of Trump.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that his biggest fans actually have the dimmest view of him. You know, what? Even like Tucker Carlson, like Ben Shapiro one time, this always stuck in my head, said that his defense of Trump on Ukraine was that he doesn't think that Trump could intend to do anything. Like Trump has his brain is so broken that if he has a hamburger in front of him, he can't even intend to eat it. It just sometimes happens to pop into his mouth. And here's Tucker saying that the president can't even determine whether or not to speak to a famous journalist or not on his own. He needed to be manipulated by that dastardly Lindsey Graham. It's just like, how dumb, I mean, how incompetent and dumb is this person that they can't make any decisions on their own? And, you know, the next delicious layer to this is that Tucker, and this just shows how corrupted Tucker has become and how much of a propaganda outlet this is, because I want to tell you something. Maybe some of our listeners don't know this, but I put this in. We did a timeline of Trump's failure, the 10 weeks that lost the coronavirus war a long time ago on the Bulwark, and you can just click on our COVID page and read it. But one entry really stuck out to me as something that I wanted to make sure people knew. On March 7th, a month after the first Woodward tapes where Trump says that he knows that the virus is worse than the flu, Tucker flew to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump to tell him that his sources say that this is actually very serious, much more serious than China has let on, and that he was disturbed by the fact that Trump wasn't taking this seriously enough and it was going to cost him the election. So an ostensible news commentator went to give the president this advice a month later. I mean, so if anybody should know how bad Trump bungled this, it's Tucker. Because Tucker, believe it or not, actually took this seriously and started covering the virus as early as February. Maybe it was because it was, allowed him to demagogue about the Chinese, but for whatever the intentions were, he actually got it right. And he knew he got it right, and he knew Trump got it wrong, and he flew there to beg him to take it seriously. And now these tapes come out that prove that Tucker was right all along and Trump was wrong all along. But rather than take a victory lap and say, I told you, that we needed to take this more seriously. This was obvious from the start to those of us who were watching the show. Rather than take the victory lap, he can't do it because he doesn't want to offend his audience by explaining how dumb Trump is. So he has to come up with this preposterous insult where the evil and dastardly Lindsey Graham is at fault. It is delicious and maddening at the same time.
Okay, now let's just step back here and ask what we've learned that's new and whether it will make a difference, because we knew that the president was downplaying this. You had that timeline, which is still up at the Bulwark, and I strongly urge people to look at that timeline. You can see all the things that he said. The Washington Post has documented this. New York Times has written about this. So what difference does it actually make that we get this story from Woodward that he said this on tape? Does it actually make any difference to the Nothing Matters crowd?
Well, this is what I wrote about this morning, with the LOL Nothing Matters Republicans. And no, it doesn't make any difference to the Nothing Matters crowd, but I think it will potentially make a political difference, one. And I think it obviously makes a difference with regards to sort of rendering a judgment on Trump's presidency and his handling of this virus, because look, I mean, it just utter incompetence and aloofness is damning, of course, and that is what we knew. But what these tapes really do show is a conscious recklessness, not just an incompetence, right? I mean, look, on February 7th in this tape, the most damning part for me is on February 7th in this tape, Trump is talking to Woodward about how much worse this is than the flu. I think he says five times worse, based on what they know at the time. He's talking about how it's an airborne virus and why that's dangerous. Over a month later, Trump is tweeting, and I believe you've retweeted this a couple times recently, Charlie, about how this is just like the flu and how it's not a big deal. And so I think that many of us suspected that he recognized that it was a big deal and just was downplaying it because he was worried about the stock market and worried about his reelection and, worried about his ego and whatever else, worried about the news coverage that day because, he has the attention span of a gnat. But I think that that this shows that this is demonstrative proof of that was the reason why he was doing this. It wasn't just aloofness. And I do think that matters in rendering this judgment. And then I do think that matters with voters because, look, this is undeniable. His numbers have gotten worse over the last 6 months because of the virus and because of the protests. And this is just another reminder for that percent of soft voters, of soft Trump folks, that about how bad he screwed this up.
Yeah, I have a couple of takes on this. I mean, first of all, there are tapes, not anonymous sources from the deep state. Remember last week it was all, we're not going to believe any of the stuff about the military because it's anonymous. Well, when people came forward and agreed, well, we still don't, believe that because it's secondhand, they're disgruntled, etc. Well, this is not anonymous. It's not secondhand. It's from Trump's own mouth it is right out there. And it is so graphic, as you point out, the consciousness of it. I was going to play the tape, but I think people have probably heard it by now. You go through what he said afterwards, as you point out, you know, so 7 days after he tells Bob Woodward that he knows how deadly it is, that he knows it could kill lots of Americans, that he knows it's not the flu. He's saying a lot of people think it goes away in April with the heat as the heat comes on. February 24th, coronavirus very much under control. Stock market starting to look good to me. February 24th.
I mean, he admits it right there, just really quick. He admits he not only admits the consciousness, market. But he admits the reason why by saying the quiet part loud, as he always does on the stock market there.
Exactly. So February 26th, when you have 15 people and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done. Next day, it's going to disappear. It's a miracle it will disappear. And then as late as March 14th, he's saying, you know, we have flu in our country, an average of 36,000 people a year, and you know, that's something we're not talking about, but as of this moment, we've lost 50. And then on March 19th, he admits to Bob Woodward, I always wanted to play it down. I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic. Now, in terms of, here, go ahead. He never wants to scare people. He never wants to alarm people, right? Except for American carnage and, you know, thugs on a plane and, you know, Mexican rapists and caravans coming to kill us, you know, and, you know, the Marxist apocalypse of the Democrats. He Cory Booker is coming for you, white suburban housewives, but he didn't want to. What he really meant, though, right, because we have to Trump-splain here, is he didn't want to panic the stock market, because really that's what it came down to. He wasn't going to prepare the country for what they needed to do to prevent hundreds of thousands of Americans to die, because he didn't want to spook the stock market.
Yeah. And a lot of people say, well, who cares about this? Like, you know, again, it's just the president's words. His actions don't matter. You know, actions are what matter. LOL, nothing matters. But here's the thing. This was an area where actually, I know this comes as a shock to our friends in the anti-Trump crowd, like presidential words matter and leadership does matter in a situation such as this, where he has the ability to shape behavior, right? And so for him, we see that it was, you know, 6 weeks between when he knew that this was serious and when, you know, his fabled first pivot. And then obviously he pivoted back to irresponsibility again, you know, daily and weekly, all the way up to our present. But if you began on February 7th, you know, encouraging people to start thinking seriously about social distancing, about getting together in large groups. If he had moved more quickly to create a testing regime to address the PPE, to make sure that hospitals were prepared. And there was a lot of time for like wasted when time was very much of the essence. And so, you know, this idea that, yeah, sure, there were plenty of other people to blame, plenty of other people that messed up, the CDC with the masks, Cuomo is a disaster, but this demonstrates that like the president knew that people should be acting differently. And even if he could have changed people's behavior 10%, 20%, I mean, that is an exponential number of human lives that could have been saved, you know, by this. And so I just, you know, it is extremely, extremely damning just on the COVID part. And it shows you how crazy this administration is and how insane we are that about all the other stuff that was revealed yesterday that doesn't even get mentioned.
So, you know, I and having lived through so many of these, this is the moment, this is it. Having lived through Access Hollywood, remember October 7th, 2016, when everybody thought the campaign was over. And Reince Priebus was saying you need to drop out of the race and everything. Now, by the way, he's saying that the president should go on the attack. So we know this nothing matters culture, but I do agree with you that this might make a difference. I mean, first of all, because we're close to 50 days away from the election, and look, this isn't going to shake Trump's base. We know that, right? This is not going to really make that much of a difference to the anti-Trumpers, but what this does is these tapes do shift the focus of the campaign back from this law and order issue, yes, which is where Trump wanted. He had changed the subject of the campaign from his failures on coronavirus, which he knew was toxic, to the cities are burning and we needed, you know, these, you know, radical Marxists are going to kill us all if we don't do something about it. Well, now the focus is back on COVID-19 And it's back on COVID-19 a week before we're going to hit that grim milestone of 200,000 American deaths. And I do think that that's going to be a moment. And now when this hits, there's no way that this story doesn't, you know, become part of that context, right? I mean, so
this goes to JBL's point that he keeps making. Yeah. He's behind. Trump's behind. He needs good news cycles, you know. And so this is, and I wrote about this today, but there is this head in the sand. You see on the from a lot of people in the commentariat that like this thing that none of these things matter because everybody's views are so. Deep-seated about Trump. And it's true that many, 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 many people have already rendered a judgment on Trump. But there is an important demographic of people that haven't. And if you look at the data, you see between basically 6 and 9 or 10% of Trump's voters from last time are saying that they're moving over to Biden. If you looked at the data for 2016, about 15% of Trump's voters said that they had an unfavorable view of him. They just hated Hillary more. So look, that is an absolutely massive swing demographic. The difference between Biden getting 5% of Trump voters last time and 10% is the difference between a very narrow, nail-biting election election college long night, and the difference between Joe Biden winning in a Ronald Reagan level landslide. So yeah, those people, they are persuadable. And on COVID, they are already have their doubts about Trump. They've been giving him a pass for the most part because, you know, this is a pandemic. Who could have predicted it? All the countries are bad. More information coming to light, including tapes that undermine that argument, that make them have second thoughts about whether actually it's true that this was, you know, a kind of black swan that couldn't have been resolved, you know, can move some of these voters. And if even if it doesn't move anybody, like you're saying, it prevents what Trump needs is news cycles to help gain some of them back, because right now he's losing.
Yeah, no, I actually, in my newsletter, I put Matthew Dowd's tweet in, you know, making the same point. You know, many in the media keep missing the point. It is not whether new information will cause Trump to drop below 42%. It's about whether new information will prevent Trump from growing his support enough to win. And that's the key. You know, in Wisconsin, you know, he may be 4 or 5 points behind, but he's consistently at 43%. Yeah. He's not going to win a state like Wisconsin unless he can get to 43 to about 47%. This is not going to make it easier for him to do that. It makes it much tougher because this is the one issue that he consistently polls, you know, really badly on. I think he's got a 37% approval rating. So here's the thing that's fascinating, because Trump is Trump. And we know that. And I don't know if there's anything more that we can actually learn about Trump, but I'm constantly fascinated by his enablers, his supporters, and his defenders. So as of this morning, yesterday afternoon as well, what have the anti-Trumpers settled into a comfortable defensive crouch yet? I mean, have they figured out how they're going to spin this? I saw that Ben Shapiro was basically going, but Biden or Pelosi also downplayed this at some point, which is actually sort of incorrect. But is that what it's going to be? Is it just going to strategic silence? They'll take a deep breath and then they'll, I don't know, find
some. Or nothing to see here. We already knew this. I mean, that's the Federalist crouch is this. Okay. Is you know, because here's the thing. Trump is verbal diarrhea.
I'm blocked by Molly Hemingway. Yeah,
yeah, look, okay. Trump is verbal diarrhea, right? So if you go through the fact that he had, you know, he had whatever, 30, 40 press conferences, you can find one sentence from all these press conferences that's like, see, look at this one sentence where he said he knew it was worse than the flu, right? Like, and so look, I just think that they are, you know, people – they've already rendered the judgment that they're going to need to be for Trump. And so they'll just backfill it. So yeah, it'll be the Nancy Pelosi in Chinatown. It's all BS. But here's the interesting thing for me, Charlie, is while those people are enraging, they're a little bit less of an anthropological curiosity for me as the people who are in there, you know, and who still won't just speak the truth about the president in the way that we've seen from, you know, some Miles Taylor, Elizabeth Newman, and some of these folks. Because this was under, you know, because this is a little bit dog bites man at this point, it was undercovered yesterday. But I just want to read Dan Coates a couple things. Dan Coates said to Bob Woodward that Trump is dangerous, unfit. He thinks he might be compromised by Putin still. He doesn't understand why some of Trump's actions. And then Fauci said he's rudderless and has the attention span that is a minus number. I mean, this is astonishing.
Well, and Mattis, what James Mattis told Coates, the president has no moral compass.
Can you imagine in another presidency? I mean, it's totally unimaginable that cabinet level officials would say that they think that the president is dangerous, unfit, no moral compass, compromised by Putin. Like, how can you believe that? And this is just it's supernova Olympic level compartmentalization to think that you believe that the president is dangerous and unfit and compromised by our enemies and has without a moral compass and has no attention span. And then to think, well, but you know, he's probably better than the other guy after all, you know, socialism or whatever.
Marxism.
I mean, that is the thing that I think that we'll need to have teams of psychiatrists studying for years and years to come.
You wrote about Miles Taylor. Miles Taylor being one of the first of the high-ranking officials in the Department of Homeland Security to break ranks, and he did the ad for Republican Voters Against Trump, and then you did a piece about him for the Bulwark, and then he was on the Bulwark podcast, and he predicted that there would be more. So and he was right, because you have Elizabeth Newman who came out, and now you have this new whistleblower coming out saying that they had told him to suppress the information about Russian disinformation
and white supremacy,
so that they could then cook up that Antifa is a real threat. So essentially, they wanted to use this to frame. I mean, look, the narrative that Trump has been pushing up until yesterday, of course, is that this major threat to America came from Antifa and wink at the white supremacists. And now we're getting a rather graphic view of what was going on. So we do seem to be having a moment. If you put together the Atlantic article and you put together the whistleblower and things like we're seeing in the Woodward book, it does feel like there's a move right now where people who have not spoken out are coming forward, and it feels like there's going to be more. Do you have that sense?
I hope so. I feel a little bit like Lucy with the football on this.
We all feel that way.
Because Miles was tweeting yesterday something about this. It's like, this was, everybody that worked in the White House that was a person of conscience or something already knew all this. And this is what they all think about him, referring to the Coates and Mattis quotes. And it's like, well then, okay, where are they? Like, I mean, how can you in good conscience leave this guy in office without saying, or risk leaving him in office for four more years without saying your piece if you believe this? I mean, that is for me the extremely frustrating part about all of this, is that it is unprecedented. It does feel like it's a lot. It does feel like there's a moment, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like it's up to the revelations meet the threat, or that the courage, yeah. I guess, internal courage meets the threat. When it comes to some of these even higher level cabinet officials speaking out, and when it comes to people like John Kelly's silence after the Atlantic article, which is
bizarre. I mean, I guess I'm a little tired of these retired generals basically saying, well, it's not my job as a retired general to speak out, except that when you took a political position, when you took a cabinet position, you stepped into a different role. So you can't keep hiding behind your, the general issue for why you're not speaking out. But I guess I am struck by the number of people that are at the moment. And, if in fact we go back to there's a little bit more than 50 days until the election, if every week there is another revelation, that will be another week where the president is on the defensive and not talking about the things he wants to talk about. This is a bad case scenario. Okay, so one little tidbit that got lost, actually a bunch of things that get lost, so many things get lost. Number one, how badly outraised the Trump campaign was by the Biden campaign, which nobody saw coming. The fact that there's a lot of concern that the Trump campaign may actually be running short of cash, which is, look, you've been involved in campaigns. That is mind-boggling. This guy, he had a, four-year head start. He had $1 billion war chest. He had the Death Star. And apparently, what did they piss through all the money?
Is it, I think this is our friend Brad Parscale's legacy. You know, they, I think, misjudged their ability to continue to kind of raise money through outrage clicks online. And I think that, and I think that, that what really happened here, and I'm sure that there is corruption and waste and, you know, somehow, you know, Don Jr. and Eric are getting made whole on all this on the backside. But I think that, that really the reason that there's the shortfall, because they probably baked all the corrupt stuff in, is that they expected Trump to be getting Biden-like, really, online fundraising numbers, because Trump and the Republicans dominated the Democrats in online fundraising all through impeachment and post-impeachment early this year. And that has dried up some. And I don't, you know, maybe that is a sign of waning enthusiasm among the base. Maybe it's a sign that they've just kind of bled all these folks dry and there's nothing out. More to get out of the turnip here. And I think that, you know, they had this anticipation that that spigot was never going to turn off. And I think the spigot's slowing down. And so they've put themselves in a tough situation there. And they're not on air right now in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a very important state. For Trump, you know, if you don't win Pennsylvania and you don't win Michigan, I think Michigan's pretty much off the table, really, for Trump at this point. So if you then add Pennsylvania, the only path to victory for him is to win all of the other swing states, and then it's a tie, and then you have to pick up the main congressional district to win by two electoral votes. I mean, that's his, or Minnesota, or you steal Minnesota, which doesn't seem likely that you'd win Minnesota and lose Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania is a critical state for them. To be down on advertising there, I think shows just how serious the problems are.
Yeah. The other story was that Trump is not doing any practicing for the debates that are coming up, because what could possibly go wrong? Is although I agree with JVL that I think despite all the hype, they're not going to make a difference either. I mean, unless somebody like throws up on stage or something.
I think that there's a downside. I'll bed wet for a second on that and take the contrary view. I think that there's a downside risk for Biden in the debates.
Oh, really?
I mean, we do in the focus groups that I've seen. You know, but there is a soft Biden support among some of this swing demo. And, you know, they're a little concerned about his, you know, performance. They don't know as much about him as you'd think, given how long he's been in Washington. And so, you know, I think in a worst case scenario type debate performance for Biden, where he really is struggling, I think it could have an impact. I don't think it's a zero. I mean, let me just say this. I definitely think it will have a bigger impact than the conventions did, or at least could potentially have a bigger impact than the conventions did.
So do you have any insight into this? Because I don't actually. Speaking of bedwetting, there's a lot of bedwetting coming out of Florida about the way in which Biden is underperforming among Hispanic voters. Look, I understand that, you know, Cuban Americans are going to vote for Republicans. That's not breaking news. But there seems to be some of the polling shows that Biden is underperforming among non-white voters, among people of, you know, voters of color. You have any insight into what's going to be the last thing on earth that I would expect would be that Donald Trump, after, you know, 4 years of, you know, playing the race card, bashing immigrants, might overperform among Hispanics and African Americans. Is that actually happening, or is that just noise?
It could be either. Trump did do a little bit better than Romney among both Hispanic and Black voters, if I'm remembering correctly. Somebody can fact check me on that, but I'm almost certain that's the case. So he got a higher percentage, slightly. I mean, you know, we're talking one or, you know, a couple points, but that's not nothing. The best theory, let's presume it's true. The best theories of the case that I have on this are: one, there's a category of older Hispanic voters for whom the socialism message really does work, and that Trump has been driving that hard and paid. And then secondly, the thing that I think is more concerning for the Democrats long term I'd be interested, you know, to have somebody on this podcast, like more of a data person, like a David Shore or somebody like that, to talk about this. But the divide between the college and the non-college among white voters potentially is something that could leak into voters of color, particularly among men. And, and you start to see non-college men, you know, who are, you know, culturally kind of more aligned with non-college white men than they are with kind of the college educated latte liberals. And that there are some cultural areas where, you know, they're, you know, attracted basically to kind of Trump's sort of brashness and devil may care attitude and non-PC attitude. And that there could be some maybe room for growth in those demos for Republicans. I don't think that's, you know, I don't expect surge, but like some slight, you know, this sort of the same trends we're seeing among white voters, you start to see a little bit with voters of color. Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but that's the best theory I've heard.
So have you started playing around with the maps? Like the 270?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you're playing. So as of today, where are you? What's your map look like?
I think Biden's over 300 electoral votes today. I think that he's going to win Arizona, win Michigan for sure. I think win Pennsylvania.
Then he wins.
And then he wins. So that's kind of what I have. I think that right now he's a slight edge in Florida, slight edge in Wisconsin. I think North Carolina is a coin flip. So I think that's where I am today. That said, I maybe this is just PTSD, but I do worry about a non-college white voter surge. And this is different than what you hear about the shy Trumper. I think that's stupid. Like that's just New York liberals who have one shy Trump friend, and they think that that is what is happening in Wisconsin. That's just not a real phenomenon in the swing states.
The Trump voters here are not shy.
Exactly.
They are very much in your face.
Yeah, but I do think that there is a potential risk that Democratic turnout stays relatively flat, slight increase, that the Democrats do better with these voters who've left Trump. Like I said earlier, this kind of 5 to 10% of voters who left him. But that is offset by a surge in non-college white voters, which is the biggest demo of non-voters. You know, when people hear about non-voters, they often think of like young people and black voters in the city.
In states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, there are a lot of those voters.
Yeah, and Florida.
Who just have not voted. Well, that's, of course, the thing about non-voters is they tend not to be voters. So I'm a little skeptical about that. But that's it. In the scenario of a Trump victory, that's my main concern, is that we're all focused on the suburbs. We're focused on urban turnout. And suddenly there's another 250,000 votes from rural Wisconsin, you know, non-college educated white voters.
Yeah, so that's the thing that worries me. But I don't think that'll happen in Michigan or Arizona. I feel pretty good about Biden in those states. And so, you know, that puts him in a good position. Then he just has to pick up another one. The fact that Trump isn't on TV in Pennsylvania,
it's amazing.
Is amazing. But there are a lot of non-college white voters out there in Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's a pretty good map for Biden right now, but not a slam dunk map.
No, I think my numbers probably line up with yours pretty closely. So, Tim Miller, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. And by the way, if you haven't done this, check out Tim's new show on Snapchat. It is well worth your time. Not your party. And our special, since we're doing a double header, our special guest coming up here on the Bulwark Podcast, Tom Ridge. Tom Ridge is a former two-term governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and he was the first secretary of the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11, a Vietnam vet who's very, very involved now in an organization called Vote Safe, which is trying to figure out how we are going to go through this election in the midst of a pandemic. And basically, Vote Safe wants all states and territories to be able to ensure that voters have accessible, secure mail-in ballots and safe in-person voting sites, and they want Congress to provide the resources. But, well, we are 53 days away from the election. Governor Ridge, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, Charlie, thanks for the opportunity. Looking forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Well, I want to talk about mail-in voting because this is becoming a very urgent issue right now in real time. But I have to ask you, as the first Secretary of Homeland Security, just to your response to some of the stuff that we are reading this morning that everybody is talking about, the whistleblower from high-ranking whistleblower from the Department of Homeland Security, who, by the way, is about the third high-ranking whistleblower from that department, to say that he was told to downplay Russian interference in the election, downplay the danger posed by white supremacist organizations. Your sense of what's going on in your old department?
Well, I certainly find the allegations troubling. They're beyond troubling. Again, I say at the outset, they're allegations. I know some of the individuals against whom these allegations have been made, so I'm not going to be judge and jury. But they're troubling because it goes against the basic norm that those who have an opportunity to inform decision makers in the public sector, in the private sector, but here it's the President of the United States, have a responsibility, a moral, ethical, and a responsibility, unvarnished, to tell the decision maker, in this instance, the President, the truth, the absolute truth, what he or she needs to know, not what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And obviously, even in this very partisan environment, without a partisan environment, I suspect there'd be an investigation, and no doubt there'll be one commencing shortly in this regard. It's a very troubling set of allegations, and I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, and of course, we have the Woodward tapes that everybody has been talking about all morning. Bob Woodward sat down for 18 on-the-record interviews with the president, and we now have the president on tape in February saying, this is a deadly thing. This is not the regular flu. This will kill a lot more people. And then a few weeks later saying that his strategy was to downplay this because he didn't want to panic anyone. Your thoughts about that?
It's, in my mind, it's somewhat ironic, Charlie, that it comes on the heels of this whistleblower allegation. If you're going to hold someone advising the president to the standard that says you speak truth to power, then those who have power, those who have that responsibility, have to be speaking truth to those who have entrusted them with that power, with that responsibility. And it seems to be it's beyond a breach of duty. It is, in my mind, just an unconscionable fact. And it is a fact because it is the president making those statements that in spite of that knowledge and in spite of his position, frankly, to inoculate, which is not necessarily the appropriate word with the given the research we're doing with therapeutics and vaccines, but a good leader would have inoculated this country with that knowledge that we view this nationally as a serious, serious public health threat. And we view this nationally as something we need to work together on, both in the private sector, to mitigate the impact and the deaths. And we need to adopt these measures, A, B, C. I know it's symbolic, Charlie, but I have to tell you, particularly after I read, again, I haven't read all the transcripts, but after I read the couple of the press accounts, I wondered what the impact would have been if in that February timeframe, maybe January, but February timeframe, the president is made aware of the gravity of the situation and the potential hazard that it has become. If he and the vice president, on each side of them, you had the Republican and Democrat leaders of the House and the Senate. On each side of them, Republican and Democrat chairman of the Republican and the Democrat National, the Governors Association, and mixed in the crowd, a few businessmen and popular athletes, and they're all wearing masks. Symbolic, yeah, perhaps, but leaders knowing the reality that their community or country may be ravaged by a pandemic. And I was just reading a book called The Splendid and the Livid, where Britons were forewarned long in advance of the first bombing, and they took precautions, and they were united in that effort to defeat Germany. Well, we have a failed leadership here, in my judgment, because had that information in his hand, I think a true leader would have used it to guide our government, better coordinate the relationships between the federal government, state, and locals, and would have probably eliminated quite a bit of the bipartisan or the partisan politics that has eked its way into the public discussion of the pandemic. Sorry for the long narrative.
No. Actually, I thought about it.
I mean, it's just...
Yeah, well, you were in the room making decisions, trying to deal with this, and you understand how the decision-making process goes.
Well, I know, there's a lot of books written on leadership, Charlie. But the fact of the matter is that strong leaders, in my mind, confident leaders, those who truly care about those who have entrusted them with that responsibility of leadership, would acknowledge that reality, that information that they've been known, and based on that knowledge and that information and the potential impact on the country or the group, would have done something, would begin to inoculate the very... They're not going to panic. The president says this is a challenge that we've got before us in America. We've responded to these challenges before. We've done it here. And there are plenty of historical anecdotes where any president could rely upon to harness the unity of the country and instead, for whatever reason, chose not to. He can explain it. I'm not going to. It's just, I think it's the death of any individual is a tragedy. The fact that a lot of people believe, and I'll just take them for what it's worth, thousands of lives could have lost. The loss of life could have been mitigated significantly had this information been shared in a thoughtful and appropriate way with the public. And as the basis for asking Americans to do simple things like wear a mask, wash your hands, separate by 6 feet, those kinds of basic things, I think Americans would have done it.
And I think the president might have gotten an approval rating near 60%, like some of the governors have gotten. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that book by Eric Larson. This book has come up on this podcast before, The Splendid and the Vile, about the Blitz in London. And you think back at the different approaches. You know, Winston Churchill did not rally the British people by saying, oh, don't worry, they're not coming. It will just vanish. Really, we don't need to do anything about it because the British, I mean, the Nazis pose no threat to us whatsoever. That is not the message that he had. You know, he stood there and he said, I have, you know, nothing to promise you but blood, sweat, tears, and toil. And then the people rallied to that. They weren't panicked by it, but they understood the necessity. They understood the danger and then the necessity of facing it. So there's a very interesting historical analogy to all of that. So Governor Ridge, I probably should know this, but you were a two-term Republican governor of Pennsylvania. You served in the George W. Bush administration. Do you still consider yourself a Republican?
Well, I'm a Ronald Reagan Republican. I view that, let's say that's a Republican Party 1.0. I don't recognize this one. This is a Republican Party 2.0. I guess that means I'm a traditionalist. And yes, I'm still a registered Republican. I still believe in the fundamentals of the party. We've abandoned them, in my judgment, across the board for the past 4 years. But I have been and will remain a Republican. I'm just a little concerned about the future of the Republican Party. And depending on what happens in the next election, will be determinative of that. I mean, when you take a look at what has transpired over the past 3.5 years, the fiscal concern about fiscal integrity and deficits has gone out the window, even in a pro-COVID environment. The notion that we are the Republicans, I would say this, Republicans and Democrats understood the president as the leader of the free world, but I think we were much more inclined to be supportive of these traditional relationships, multilateral and bilateral relationships, and much more supportive of them as we need to be than this president is. And regardless of what the Democrats thought of it, they've been undermined by this president. I mean, I don't go on to the long list, but I don't think that this administration has reflected the basic tenets of the party, one of which I've always felt was, okay, individual accountability and individual responsibility. And for the president during the COVID crisis, basically to kind of insulate himself, if you might borrow a phrase, build a wall around himself, somehow he's not responsible. Again, a basic tenet flies in the face of what I thought one of the most important principles of the Republican Party, individual accountability and individual responsibility. But it seems he's unwilling to take it for some of the poor decisions or no decisions that have come out of the administration.
Well, let's talk about the election because, of course, the president is doing what he does. Won't say best, but he's back tweeting about mail-in ballots and about the election. This is a president who has cast great doubt on the legitimacy of the election, on the safety of mail-in voting. And I want to get your sense, because this is something that I know that you've been working on very intensely. It's one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you about this, because I am obsessed with the all the things that can go wrong over the next 53 days. I see that you wrote a joint letter with a former governor of Michigan urging states like Pennsylvania to begin counting some of these mail-in votes before Election Day, because otherwise it may take, I think your phrase was that this may be an election month. So give me your sense of where we are at right now, how worried you are about this, the first ever pandemic election we've had, and the role that mail-in ballots are going to play.
Well, the pandemic has changed how you do your job, how I do mine. It's changed family relationships, business relationships. I mean, let's face it. Once we get through this, we won't be back to norm. There'll be a new norm. We know that. But one of the most important elements of our democracy, voting, has been substantially affected by the pandemic. And the best indication is the unprecedented use of absentee ballots during the primary season. You mentioned Pennsylvania. We had historically had 5 or 6% voting absentee in the primaries. This time we had up to 50%. And you know, and I know, and most thoughtful people will know that absentee ballots themselves do not provide any political advantage to either party or to any candidate. They just don't. The benefit of the absentee balloting inures to the candidate or the party that identifies those voters who need an absentee ballot to reflect their choice. And what Jennifer Granholm and I have been doing for the past couple months, and it is a bipartisan effort, because election security and counting votes and that sanctity of the election isn't a political issue. It must be bipartisan or perhaps even apolitical. But we basically have said that we need safe and secure in-person balloting opportunities, as well as safe and secure absentee ballot opportunities. And it's ironic, if not hypocritical, that the president, who has and continues to vote absentee, by the way, this time he will vote absentee in Florida, would be undermining this most fundamental process in the institutions of government in our democracy, the election, by proclaiming more than once that he's certain he could win, and the only way he could lose would be fraud, fraudulent abuse of absentee ballot, which flies in the face of 40 years of history and investigation, even under the careful eye and data analysis of a conservative think tank called the Heritage Foundation. It also flies in the face of the analysis of a highly respected conservative Republican lawyer, Ben Ginsburg, who I know marginally, for whom I have enormous respect, who has represented the party, presidential candidates, et cetera, since the 1980s, who basically said in a Wall Street, and I think it was in a Washington Post editorial yesterday, that the allegations of fraud, if I might give you the Cliff Notes version, the allegation of fraud is in of itself a fraud. It's not going to happen. And that's why Jennifer, notwithstanding that, Jennifer Granholm and I just want to make sure that Americans, because of the pandemic, are given options, one of which is the absentee ballot. And by the way, Florida starts counting, I think, 22 days ahead. Arizona, which is also a swing state, 80% of those folks out there vote absentee. So, Mr. President, I frankly think what he's done is close to be binding as un-American as anything a president has done to undermine the legitimacy and the trustworthiness of this sacred process that we have in this country by these false allegations is certainly unworthy of anyone, but particularly an incumbent president of the United States.
You know, you said something that I think is very interesting, that this should be a bipartisan, apolitical issue. And really, up until this year, absentee ballots had not been a partisan issue. Republicans had it for a long time dominated in some states, the early voting, the universe of early voting. But now it has become hyperpartisan. It's become very, very polarized. So I wonder whether we have any indication of how this is going to play out, because right now, every survey that I'm seeing, including in states like Wisconsin, there is a real partisan breakdown where Democrats are far more likely to vote by mail than Republicans. So the good news and the bad news would be that has Donald Trump actually succeeded in suppressing some of his own vote? Because I know a lot of Republicans who traditionally voted by mail, and by casting doubt on mail-in votes, is it possible that he is going to reduce the Republican use of absentee balloting?
Well, I'm fascinated by analysis because I happen to share it.
Yeah.
The fact is, it's if you want to preserve the majority that you have in the Senate, Mr. President, and I just wonder if Mitch is just shakes his head in disbelief and mumbling under his breath, why would you discourage Republican voters who historically have voted absentee and maybe those who've got pre-existing conditions, loyal Republicans that just don't want to go to the polls, et cetera, from voting and by discrediting the absentee balloting process? So it absolutely makes no sense to me. It is counterintuitive and also, in my judgment, counterproductive if he wants to preserve the Senate. And if I'm a challenger over in the House, if you're trying to pick a few votes. I mean, I just kind of shake my head in disbelief why there hasn't been a louder and more sustained public outcry from incumbent elected officials challenging the president's statement that the only way he could lose is if the election's rigged. It is beyond despicable, in my judgment, for a statement for the President of the United States to make that observation and conclusion. I mean, it's self-serving, it's narcissist, and it's wrong, Mr. President. The voters will decide, not you. And part of that process has to do with absentee ballots. And that's why Governor Granholm and I, we're not out promoting one side or the other. We just want to make sure that the options are there for people throughout the country. One great example is the Kentucky situation where the Secretary of State is elected Republican, the governor is an elected Democrat, and they're working very, very hard to make sure that they get safe and secure in-person balloting and absentee ballots. It's an apolitical issue. Everybody ought to be joined in the notion that we ought to maximize participation, maximize voter turnout, and let the people decide who takes the oath of office on January 20th, not the president looking into his own personal crystal ball, proclaiming the future and suggesting that anything but his conclusion would be contrary to the facts. So the facts are, Mr. President, the folks haven't voted, and he's taken this notion of delay, and there will be delay because of the unprecedented use of absentee ballots, and suggested there'll be a fraud. Final comment. You and I don't know these folks very well. I know some of them, Charlie. You got Republicans and Democrats at the local level who for years and years give up a couple of days a year. It's their contribution to this process of self-government. They're local election officials. They work very hard. They view the vote and their mission as a sacred and important one. I think they're the guardians of democracy. And for this president, frankly, to suggest that they haven't in the past, nor will they in the future, do their job to make sure that every vote that has been properly rendered is properly counted, again, is not only a lack of confidence, but I think a bloody insult in the face of their service to this country. But again, you don't want me to get going on who served their country and who hasn't. But they are guardians of the democracy, and we should be grateful for their presence and for their work.
So let me ask you a factual question. I don't know whether we have all the answers on this. And it's a very practical question, which is the spoilage rate for mail-in votes. I saw an account, and I haven't verified it, out of North Carolina, where there were rather alarmingly high number of ballots that were spoiled because of the failure to either to have a signature on the ballot or to have a witness on the ballot. Do we have some rule of thumb? Are you getting any indication of whether this is going to be a problem? Because this is one of those things that could have tremendous impact in swing states, especially if you have Democrats disproportionately using the ballots. If you have a 10% spoilage rate, that could flip the election. So what are you seeing? What are you hearing about that?
Well, Charlie, I think that's a very good point. And as strong an advocate I am for the safe and secure options, there are rules and regulations appropriate to the use of the absentee ballot. And these local officials, and there is a process, some of it's electronic, some of it's personal overview, but there are guidelines and rules that, in my judgment, basically assure the legitimacy of the ballot itself. And I think it is incumbent upon the leaders of both parties, state and local officials, the media itself, there are rules and regulations around absentee ballot, just like there's rules and regulations around everything else. And we cannot deviate from that. And so I think the challenge is not changing the rules or second-guessing the outcomes. The challenge is making sure in the next 2 months that everybody understands the appropriate way to exercise this civic responsibility. I think it's a privilege to vote, Charlie. Mm-hmm. I think it's a civic responsibility. But exercise your civic responsibility in a way consistent with very specific guidelines. It's not that difficult. And if there's a lack of knowledge and information, it falls on both parties and the leaders of both parties, particularly at the local level, state and local level, to inform the public so they better understand and comprehend what they need to do. Will there be a spoilage rate? That is possible. There's been that way for a long, long time. But that is far and away different from the kind of massive fraud that the president's talking about. One doesn't exist. The other can be remedied or minimized just with education.
Governor Tom Ridge, thank you so much for joining me. Tom Ridge is a former two-term governor of Pennsylvania, the very first secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and an outspoken advocate for mail-in voting. His organization is Vote Safe. You can find it online. Governor Ridge, thank you so much for joining me today.
Charlie, it's been a great pleasure. Hope we have a chance to continue the conversation either before or after the election, but stay safe, be well to you and your listeners. It's been a pleasure to join you. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are 53 days to go until the election.